The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm John Henley. So, phone hacking saga week three. And the pace of events shows no sign of slowing. Parliament may have risen for summer, but this story looks set, as the saying goes, to run and run. The head of the Metropolitan Police and his key lieutenant have resigned, as has News International's Rebecca Brooks. And at a much-hyped parliamentary hearing this week, the Murdochs pleaded ignorance to the full extent of alleged corruption within their organisation.
I was absolutely shocked, appalled and ashamed when I heard about the Millie Dowler case only 2 weeks ago.
Meanwhile, David Cameron tells MPs he has nothing to apologise for over the appointment of former News of the World editor Andy Coulson as his spin doctor. At least, not yet.
If it turns out I've been lied to, that would be a moment for a profound apology. And in that event, I can tell you I will not fall short.
Cameron told MPs that with hindsight, he wouldn't have employed Coulson. That didn't placate Ed Miliband.
It's not about hindsight, Mr. Speaker. It's not about whether Mr. Coulson lied to him. It is about all the information and warnings that the Prime Minister ignored. He was warned, and he preferred to ignore the warnings.
The Guardian's Media Talk podcast this week looks at the wider implications of all this, but here, obviously, we're into the politics. So how much damage has the phone hacking saga done to the Prime Minister? Joining me to discuss this, I have in the studio Guardian columnist Julian Glover and John Harris, and on the line, our columnist Martin Kettle. Welcome to all of you. Julian, if I could start with you. Cameron faced his party's 1922 committee of backbenchers last night. What was the outcome of that? Are they still 100% behind him after another pretty tough week?
Well, they're 100% behind him staying as leader. They've got lots of gripes and unhappinesses with the way he's handled this and the way he employed Andy Coulson. He was strengthened, I think, by the way Ed Miliband has stopped seeming like the nation's leader on this cause, feeling quite above politics. Perhaps the moment Gordon Brown weighed in last week began to make it a much more party battle. As soon as Labour Party starts bashing Tories, the Tories tend to cheer and bang the desks for the Tory Prime Minister, whether or not they really think he's doing it right or not. And that's what happened. So there was a bit of hype amongst people in the morning and the night before, saying this was going to be the moment that Cameron's leadership was really under threat. Instead, it was all just a bit of hooray, hooray, let's all go on holiday.
Yeah, Martin, I mean, there's clearly no smoking gun, is there, that's going to put Cameron's position at risk here. But there remains a kind of a slight feeling of slipperiness about the whole thing. I mean, one commentator noted that Cameron's using what you might call the Clinton defence. I did not have inappropriate discussions about B-Sky-B with that woman, Rebecca Brooks. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I think there isn't a smoking gun yet, but I do think that Cameron still has a number of questions to answer, and those could become quite difficult for him. Obviously, it's very difficult to know what he did and didn't say in conversations which may or may not have been recorded or annotated. But it seems pretty surprising, given that he was given so many opportunities in the session in the Commons yesterday to get himself off that hook, that he conspicuously failed to do so. You know, he's had 26 meetings with News International executives during the past 15 months at a time when the question of the takeover of B-Sky-B by the Murdoch company is absolutely the central, front and central issue for News International, and at a time when the whole question of phone hacking, you know, is a real open sore. And so, you know, what did he discuss in those meetings? And you know, what indeed did, as Nick Robinson says on his blog this morning, what did George Osborne discuss in his many meetings with them too? These links are not resolved yet, and I think they could yet come back and make life very difficult for Cameron. I think he is in a very he's in a contingent position at the moment. He's been damaged.
Yeah, and John, I mean, adding to that, I suppose, is the news today that Coulson wasn't given the usual high level of security clearance that's required for number 10, the implication being, I suppose, that he might not have passed it. So, I mean, that altogether, that adds up to quite a lot of fishy things in Cameron's approach to his dealings around Coulson, doesn't
it? Yeah, there are other stories which may yet blow up. I mean, in the last, 24 hours, that
allegation has arisen that members of the civil service may have been bugged, perhaps on the say-so of people within Downing Street. I mean, that's a fantastically explosive thing when that happens. This business of Neil Wallace's... Neil Wallace clearly is an extremely toxic figure at the moment. This business of Neil Wallace's visits to Downing Street and the extent to which he advised Coulson, as you've said already, the question of if he didn't have inappropriate conversations about B-Sky-B with the management of News International, what exactly was an appropriate conversation? I mean, that was never asked in the House yesterday. It was an obvious follow-up question, but MPs very often let you down on that score, as we saw as we saw on the Select Committee. So there's loads here. I mean, I think another interesting question is how this is playing with the public. It's a sort of trope within News International newspapers to some extent, and certainly on the Tory benches, that the public is becoming bored of this and there are more important things to talk about. Inevitably, there's some truth to that. But I think we're at a sort of halfway stage here, as all scandals tend to work, whereby we're now into minutiae and quite sort of desiccated investigation, which won't attract the public's attention. But as and when these things are discovered, inevitably come September or October, and Coulson is bailed to appear.
Not just as and when. I mean, you've listed a series of possible speculations, some of which might be true and some of which might not. It's very, very important to not just assume that if we ask... I mean, I think many of the people pursuing this story have been right, and much of what they said has been right. Some of what they said has been wrong. And it's important that we try and separate the two and that we don't just make a series of possible speculative assertions and then assume from that that there is a scandal and it's just a moment till it's discovered. It is possible that the answer to some of these questions is things did not go wrong, things were not done
wrong. No, but if we're going to...
And that really is one of the things that's deeply, deeply annoyed me about the way this has been discussed in the last week, is we have reached a stage in which assertions are being made that are not substantiated.
Well, some of those assertions that I just mentioned, I mean, they're not assertions that have been made solely by journalists working for this paper. I mean, the business of Coulson paying the police, for example, is an allegation which has been made on the back of, as far as I understand it, a cache of emails which was left with News International's lawyers. So you have to bear that in mind. You know, there are allegations being made by all sorts of people for all sorts of reasons, and it isn't so to characterise this purely as a matter of journalists making accusations, I think is slightly misplaced.
No, I think John's point, if I can just come in, I think John's point about this taking some time to play through is right. And I think, look, I don't know, and probably we don't know exactly what is going to come out. Julian's right on that point, and we must not rush our fences or do whatever metaphorical thing we shouldn't be doing on this. But, I mean, just, you know, and it's easy always to, you know, to refer to smoking guns and Watergate and so on. It's worth remembering that actually the Watergate process took an awfully long time to play its way through. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't one of those things which...
It wasn't all over in a fortnight.
It wasn't all over in a few days. You know, it was a real slow burn. And in the end, it took more than 2 years. Now, I'm not therefore saying that, you know, Cameron is Nixon and he will be humiliatingly ejected from office in 2 years' time. I don't say that at all. But I do think you just have to be a bit patient and let the process work its way through, which is the point we've now got to, I think.
Has Cameron made a mistake by not actually apologising for...
Politicians and apologies is always an extremely thorny and chewy area. I mean, look at the contortions that Mr. Blair had to go through about saying sorry for the Iraq war or whatever it was. So I think there's a danger of making everything a bit too banal if you go on that script. It was quite remarkable that he said if he had his time over again, he wouldn't have hired him.
I mean, the tangled nature of his future apology for a possible conviction of Andy Coulson was quite extraordinary. Lots of conditionals. And
it was very convoluted.
You know, I can assure you that in the future, I will apologise if it turns out that X happens.
Hey, he said quite openly as to what he'd actually
do. He has promised a profound apology. I mean, that's his own words. I don't think I've ever seen...
And he said he would not fall short.
In my lifetime, I don't think I've ever seen a profound apology from a politician. They're usually sort of pat. So as and when we get a profound apology, or if we get one, to be true to what Julian said before, clearly that would be a very fascinating spectacle.
Cameron is very good at apologising when he chooses to. Remember that he did actually deliver the most graceful apology, I think, and historically important apology by a modern British politician in relation to Northern Ireland. He's good at that, and I think it's one of his assets in his relationship with the public, which has always seen him, which has seen him as somebody who kind of is on a wavelength. The question is whether all of this has damaged that.
Julian, there's one little piece of minutiae that is beginning beginning to look increasingly important. There's serious questions about the conduct of Cameron's chief of staff, Ed Llewellyn. Now, what can you just explain to us? What is he supposed to have done or not done, and how seriously is Number 10 treating that?
Well, I mean, I should begin by saying Ed Llewellyn is a friend of mine, and I believe completely in his honesty and probity, and I think he's a very impressive individual who's worked with people in different parties in all sorts of jobs. He worked in Hong Kong for the governor. He worked in Bosnia for Paddy Ashdown. So he's not a typical sort of right-of-centre Tory aide in the sort of thick of it mould. Okay. He's an unusual person, and that's why he's interesting in this story. He's also very close to Cameron. He was slightly older than Cameron. He was at school with Cameron, in that school where everybody in this government seems to have, seems to have been. He's really accused of two separate things, one of which is not passing on information and warnings, including from The Guardian, or really just alerting the Prime Minister and then the Leader of the Opposition to the nature of this story. And I think, you know, it's clear that the people around Cameron didn't do that. Cameron himself could have noticed this if he'd wanted to read The Guardian, and it becomes unclear whether he actually does as often as he should. So that's one charge, and that's a process charge, and partly that's an internal thing. You know, did they feel he did the right job? Or indeed, was he trying to protect Cameron because he thought if you can have deniable plausibility, you know. Anyway, the other aspect is specifically about a suggestion by John Yates that he talk to Cameron about the nature of the investigation. Mm. Now, this, I think, is more complex. He was emailed by John Yates, and I think Ed Llewellyn operated, I will say, inevitably in the right way in this, and I think that's why Downing Street's backed him up so much. John Yates didn't say, I feel at this point in this investigation, it's important that we talk to the Prime Minister and brief him in a formal setting. You know, he said, at another meeting, which is happening anyway, I could, in the side of this meeting, tell you about what went on. It's the side bit that I think was quite suspicious in the email initially from Yates. That's a strange way to behave. He obviously didn't mention the subject. They're trying to avoid freedom of information requests, so you have to evade mentioning the word. It's a bit like talking about Voldemort or Macbeth or something. You have to sort of hide the truth. Ed Llewellyn wrote back saying, I don't think it would be appropriate to do that, and I want to make it clear that we haven't had any conversations about this. In an email that also avoided mentioning the subject, that dare not speak its name. Now, it's said that he cleared that with Jeremy Hayward, the civil servant responsible, that this was the proper way to deal with it. He wanted to separate the Prime Minister from operational police matters. There's a long history of debate about whether politicians should be involved in operational police matters. Mm. When Damien Green was arrested, we didn't have ministers wading in and being warned about it. They didn't know it was happening. And at that point, Labour ministers said operational matters should be separate from politicians. Was it right? Was it wrong? I don't know. I think the alternative would have been worse and would have looked worse in the papers had he emailed back saying, yeah, give us the full goss on what's going on. We better, you know, really know. Either way, it's tricky. He's in one of those jobs where you do deal with tricky things, and we just a little insight into one of them. I don't think there's any deep wrongdoing, and I think he'll be okay.
Okay, well, time will tell, I guess. Martin, I mean, Cameron is pretty lucky in the sense, I suppose, that Parliament has now risen. We're in recess. How is he going to play it over the summer? How does he move on from now?
Well, I think he recognises that this has actually knocked his government off course, that he's got rebuilding to do. I think, you know, everything really focuses on the autumn. I think the recess, you know, it is actually a much needed recess in some respects, and I think, you know, everything will gear up for the party conferences in a very traditional way. They're all going to be difficult party conferences and interesting, or at least certainly the two coalition parties are going to be very interesting. Perhaps Ed Miliband's performance has secured him a safer passage through the conference season. I think what Cameron has got to do is to preserve that very strong sense that, you know, he is a fine, honest leader with the kind of, you know, with the antennae which enable him to pick up things that voters understand. And I think he is, you know, really in danger of losing that.
Well,
I think
he
really on the line.
It's true to say, I mean, he had that fairly unerringly up until now, hadn't he? But is it true that also that through this whole affair, actually it's Ed Miliband who's sort of come to the fore and found his voice, as it were?
Yes. I mean, if you look at, as much as there is an idea around at the moment, I think this is true in terms of party share of the electorate's support. Although, interesting, the Lib Dems appreciably in most polls have gone up. And I actually think the Lib Dems will have an easier conference than they would have done had this not happened.
Yeah, this and the NHS really helped.
This is a nice badge of difference for the Lib Dems. I thought the Lib Dems would be very, very choppy this September. I'm not quite sure that's the case. But anyway, as much as the Tory and Labour shares of the vote in certain polls anyway, Julian's the expert here, have been broadly the same as they were before this, there was a Mori poll on Reuters yesterday in which Ed Miliband's personal rating for the first time exceeded that of David Cameron, but he appeared to be out of IDS land in terms of the lowliness of his personal rating. That's significant.
Just to sort of add to that, though, we did have a poll in The Guardian this week, conducted over the weekend, so you know maybe things have settled down now, people have begun to notice Ed Miliband a bit more, but Ed Miliband's rating had gone up from 28 to 31, and that was still low, that was doing a good job, still lower than Nick Clegg, I think he was on 33, something like that.
And Murray apparently is always sobering.
He had fewer negatives. He had fewer negatives than Nick Clegg. So his, but only 58% of people who voted Labour at the last election thought Ed Miliband was doing a good job, and that was questioning stopped on Sunday. So definitely there was an improvement in his rating, and it may keep going up. It could be one of those things that takes time, as all of this is. It'll take years.
But Ed Miliband's most urgent predicament, strange as this may sound, is not about the electorate. I mean, 3 or 4 weeks ago, his most urgent predicament was about the amount of noises off about how supposedly inadequate his leadership was from elements of the Shadow Cabinet and the Labour Party more widely. I mean, there's awful polls on Labour List website and all that, and that seems to have stalled now. Ed Miliband's position is much more secure. And he has themes for his conference speech. I don't know whether he'll use this, but if you look at the speech that he made the day John Yates resigned, Monday, this seems like 1,000 years ago.
It does, doesn't it?
Monday, he made this speech in which he talked about a new responsibility agenda. I thought that was a pretty convincing speech. Probably the most convincing speech he's made since the speech he made last September when he took over. If he develops those themes, he widens this into a critique of the lingering fallout from the expenses crisis, the banks and so on. He can sort of tap a bit into a British equivalent of sort of old school American populism, the little guy versus the big vested interests. I think he might play a blinder at
John, you broaden it out a little bit. You did a piece this week in G2 in which you talked about the unmasking of a British power elite.
That was the sub-editor's phrase, not mine.
Is it, I mean, what is that? Does it really exist?
Yeah, I was just quite struck when, in the great sort of noise of coverage that surrounded this, not just in terms of the frequency of Cameron's meetings, for example, with News International executives, but how much there is a whole milieu built around these people, Brooks and the Murdochs and so on, which just extends amazing. I didn't know that Sir John Chilcot, who clearly was centrally involved in a lot of the intrigue around Iraq, is a director of Times newspapers, or that John Whittingdale, the chair of the Commons Culture, Media and Sport Committee, was invited to Les Hinton's wedding. He turned him down, but they obviously were close enough for that to happen. And then in the Daily Mail...
Or, of course, that Gordon Brown invited newspaper editors to various family events. But or that Ed Miliband saw News International 11 times. When you think in the list, he saw the editor of The Guardian twice since he became leader. So this is, you're certainly right, I agree with you on this. It's not just a Tory party.
I was about to say, I mean, the point is, in the piece that I wrote, there was a thing, thank you, which I saw from, I think I saw first in the Daily Mail, was this story about Elizabeth Murdoch and Matthew Freud, a millionaire PR husband, have throwing this big bash in the Cotswolds, the Chipping Norton set again. And the guest list is incredible. So to answer Julian's point, of course, Douglas Alexander, of all people, was there. Not someone I associate with bashes in the Cotswolds. I do now. James Pennell, Peter Mandelson, David Miliband went. Mark Thompson, Director General of the BBC. Robert Peston was there. On and on it went.
We weren't asked, were we?
Ed Vasey. No, I've not. Michael Gove, all the way to Lily Allen. I mean, it's just...
Do you think people have fun at these events? Or do they just stand around eyeing each other up, saying who else has been invited?
They just look absolutely gassed.
But John, your conclusion...
A field full of people looking over each other's shoulders.
Very pleased to see who's not there.
Exactly.
And your conclusion with all this is essentially that the great British public is just going to become increasingly disillusioned with everybody.
There's a danger if across broadcast in the media and politics across all parties, there's this impression of a very cloistered elite who live lifestyles which regular Joes would never even begin to understand. And the Murdoch story has been the trigger for all that, but it's revealed that. And I think post-expenses, there is this, it's another media trope that the public have lost interest in, you know, expenses doesn't register with him anymore. There is massive embedded cynicism on the back of A, the Iraq war, and B, the expenses crisis within the public mind. And in my opinion, Hatgate, or whatever we're going to call it, really hasn't helped. And therefore, with the best will in the world, Ed Miliband may have some difficulty getting real traction out of this, because I think the public watch the news and just think, there you all are. You're just a great, stinking mass of people that we don't identify with.
All in
with.
It together, yeah. Julian, the highlight of the week before, I guess, Cameron's appearance in the Commons was obviously the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee on Tuesday, the Cameron, the Murdochs and the Rebecca Brooks summonsed. I mean, you know, expectations, if you'll forgive me, were sky high around this. Did it live up to its billing?
It's a piece of drama, I think it did, really. Just to see the kind of old man dragged it a bit into the daylight, blinking and not saying very much. As a piece, it was brilliant to watch, certainly the first hour, of just going, look, he can speak, and that's what his voice sounds like. It's amazing. And look at the relation with the son and the wife, and that was all brilliant. As a, you know, I want to go to the theatre and see it again. As a thing that gave us facts in the story, probably not. And there were
nothing others, very new came out of it.
Very new, little new. But then that was probably, you know, as we now say, always going to be the case. But I think it was more interesting, more enjoyable watch, even before the bus stop that took place. And then everybody will say, well, only if the committee had been better, it would have got the truth. Well, I don't know. They were pretty rehearsed, and they wasn't. I thought the questioning was in some places better than it often is from select committees. bit unfair on backbench MPs to say, you know, you should have pulled them to pieces in 2 hours in the way that nobody else has done in the last 40 years.
Yeah. John, how did you see it?
Even if nothing was said, a spectacle, those things are great to watch, and you read immense amounts into people's body language. So the fact that James Murdoch told his dad to stop gesticulating, and at one point, before she slapped the custard pie, and Wendy Deng also sort of grabbed hold of Rupert Murdoch's hands as if to say, calm down a bit here. He appears to be, despite the fact he's an American citizen, the most Australian person in the world. I mean, the gruffness of his responses was magnificent.
I think we're slightly missing something here.
I was going to say, I don't know whether you're going to mention this, Martin. One fascinating thing came out of this, which has played out since, which is that it was established, and James Murdoch expressed, in my opinion, a fairly unconvincing surprise about this, that News International have carried on paying Glenn Mulcair's legal fees.
True.
That's
yes.
Amazing.
That is true. I think we're just missing a couple of points here. I mean, one is, I think it was possible to get a pretty clear sense of the inadequate nature of corporate governance within News International from that session. It wasn't sort of nailed in some dramatic courtroom drama kind of way, but I think it was a very strong message that this is not a company where there is a proper accountability up and down the line. That's number one. The second thing, which is a kind of bigger political point, is this was the first time that Rupert Murdoch is really, I think, the most important person in British life since Churchill. And it was the first time ever that he had been forced to come and give some account, albeit a kind of mumbling and odd account, of what he was doing to Parliament. And I think it's a symbolic moment, but also it's a watershed moment. And I think that it's going to be much, much more difficult now for the movers and shakers of the whole media world to resist parliamentary accountability of some degree. And I think, you know, if politicians can now say, look, Murdoch's done it, you've got to do it, and, you know, we want to know what you're doing. And I think that some form of accountability of the media within Parliament is a good thing. I don't think it interferes with press freedom. I think it's a good, proper, civic thing. And, you know, I think this was a big historical moment.
And John,
I just agree with everything Martin has said, apart from what he said about Murdoch being the most significant figure in British public life since Churchill, because surely Thatcher comes after Churchill.
I just want to one last point on this whole phone hacking scandal before we move on, because other things have been happening this week. Martin, we've now got, and there's another panel of sort of media grandees who are going to be tasked now with investigating journalism, essentially, in this country. Is it going to provide anything more than kind of political cover for Cameron? What do you think is going to come out of that? Very briefly, if you could.
Well, I think the precedents are bad. There have been a number of such inquiries in the past, and nothing whatsoever has come of them. I suspect that the press from left and right is going to draw together and defend against anything very significant coming out of these inquiries. But let's just say also, there are an awful lot of inquiries now in motion in a whole variety of things. And we haven't talked about the police yet. What's happened this week in policing in Britain is enormous, with huge potential for change. So there's a lot that is being, a lot of seeds are being sown, and we don't know yet know what the scale of the crops will be.
John, one very brief point.
Just quickly, I mean, the point about where the archetypal British public inquiry now sits within the modern understanding of transparency and scrutiny. I mean, when I watched the Chilcot inquiry, I thought, this looks massively old-fashioned and anomalous and weird. This idea that you get some of the great and the good and Shami Chakrabarti and put them in a room and they sort of slightly earnestly and augustly ponder and ask questions and so on, while this massively lively conversation is breaking out across the world thanks to modern means of communication, there's a hell of a disconnect between those two things. And I think that tension will really be inflamed by this.
There's also a risk of competition between inquiries. There are, you know, arguably 12 separate inquiries underway into aspects of this, and many of them overlap, and many of the witnesses will have to appear many times, and it that also blurs the clarity of what is going on, probably intentionally.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's move on now. So, I mean, the world does obviously continue to turn outside European leaders are meeting today, funnily enough, for their latest effort to apply some kind of kiss of life to the single currency. Martin, I mean, this is a very momentous day as well, isn't it? If they fail, this really could end up as a huge, monumental crisis. What role does Britain have to play, if any, in that?
Well, I mean, the British position is that we are not going to be involved in any further bailouts and loans or subsidising any further form of bailout fund. But the reality is that we are affected by these things anyway, and our economic strength is prosperity, such as it is at the moment, is directly affected by these events, which could certainly knock confidence in the British economy, which, after all, is performing in a rather sluggish and poor way. So, I mean, these things do matter. Angela Merkel says today is not absolutely the crucial day, and since she is pretty much the crucial player, it may be that everything is deferred to another day. And, you know, every day that there isn't an implosion is a good day in that sense for the Eurozone.
But I can't continue putting it off forever.
In the end, Greece is going to have to default, and the question is, how do you manage that? And I would say, I wrote a piece about this a few weeks ago, you know, that has to be the approach we take. We try, you know, what is the best way of sympathetically managing the failure of the European project. That's really, I think, what should frame British policy over the coming years.
Julian, I mean, George Osborne isn't even there today. He's been criticised for that by Ed Balls, by the way. Is it the case that the government sees this as a Eurozone problem that it really has no stake in whatsoever?
I think there's a risk of that happening. I mean, one reason he's not there is we're not a Eurozone country, partly thanks to the valiant efforts of Ed Balls to keep us out of the Euro. Osborne would have no choice if Blair had got his way. There is a real danger for the Conservative Party that it goes, hooray, hooray, look, Europe's terrible. We told you all along, this isn't our problem. And we're a sort of Finland, or even more than Finland, in the Europe. Norway sitting out
on the edge.
And of course we're not. You know, our trade is with Europe. We need to be integral to this. I think the government has been better at its relations with Europe and better at the relations during this crisis than some might have predicted before the election, particularly if it was a purely Conservative government. I mean, they've kept the jeering at a fairly low level. They've sort of engaged. There's good relationships, particularly between Cameron and Merkel. Sarkozy is more difficult. But yes, there's a real risk of that. Nick Clegg, today has given a speech in which he's trying to warn about that and to remind people Britain is part of Europe and needs to trade with it and needs to engage with it, and the collapse of the euro is our problem. I think the government knows that. One thing is, it's just not really clear what they should do. We could say Osborne should be more engaged, but what is it? He's not going to be in this debate. This has been stitched up between France and Germany even before the summit begins, with everybody else just rubber stamping it. If you're a junior member of the euro, you just get issued a bit of paper, told what to do. You're not allowed to join the conversation, let alone Britain.
John, we're wrapping up now. Murdoch, foam pies, euro, you know, completely dominated. I mean, a lot has been knocked out of the news or off the news pages.
And the Southern African famine, for example. I mean, and also the increasingly, or apparently, ongoingly parlous state of the British economy. I mean, the second quarter growth figures of due next week, that could be a hell of a blow for the government. Probably might inflict more serious short-term damage, at least, to the government than anything we've heard so far in the course of the phone hacking debate. Just to go back to Osborne, I mean, we make it sound as if Osborne hasn't got a position. He has got a position, and something, a quite interesting political turnabout has happened here, which is for years the Foreign Office has fought shy of urging greater fiscal integration, for example, within Europe, because it would create a two-speed Europe with Britain at the periphery. And actually, seemingly very, very quickly, the British policy position has changed. And Osborne is urging, very, very ironic, a Eurosceptic Conservative urging greater fiscal integration. And clearly, the fear of anybody who takes a different position is of Britain sitting on the outside of Europe and all the terrible drawbacks that would result from that. So we're playing, I mean, I think that, you know, there are high British stakes within all this being played for. It just so happens that for whatever reason, we're not there, but we have money in the game.
Go back to Nixon. It'll be, you know, Nixon goes to China, it'll be Osborne that takes us to integration.
Well, on that note, we'd better call it a day there. I think that's all we've got time for this week, except to say that we're interested to know what you think of our podcasts. If you'd like to tell us, please do email politics.weekly@gmail.com. That's politics.weekly@gmail.com. My thanks then to John Harris, Julian Glover and Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm John Henley, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.